Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Media Voices, the podcast that brings you all the news and the views from around the media world. I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
This episode, we are going to hear from Meg Cramer about Trump Inc., a podcast that takes a deep look at the unanswered questions around the US president's business dealings. So we spoke about why a collaborative team took on what might be a coast-to-coast crime scene, why a podcast can ask questions while an article must provide answers, and why great journalism transcends mediums. But to begin with, the BBC and ITV are in talks to launch a Netflix rival called BritBox. So Esther, why don't you take us through exactly what's going on with this?
If I knew. The BBC and ITV are kind of allegedly in the concluding stage of discussions to create, I quote, a one-stop shop for British box sets. Except this is apparently already a thing in the US. They've already got 500,000 subscribers. And I think it's supposed to host, you know, it's going to host things like Poldark and a lot of the ITV and BBC crossovers. I just find this a bit strange because a lot of this ends up on Netflix. So does this mean that they're going to end up pulling content from Netflix?
Yeah, they'll join the club of everybody who is pulling content from Netflix to support their own subscription. That's just what everyone's doing.
But I presume we won't have to have a license fee to watch this stuff.
You haven't got a license fee anyway.
I haven't as of last weekend. Yeah, I only tend to watch stuff on the commute, and it just got to the stage I was like, well, there's only one thing I actually want to watch on iPlayer, so let's give Netflix a try. And that means that I'm not going to pay for both. So yeah, I've cancelled the license fee, and Netflix is half the price.
You don't sound like you support this, Peter.
I'm confused by it, like Esther, but from a different direction.
Go on.
Can you imagine the Director General of the BBC on Dragon's Den pitching this? I get it for the States, I really do. You know, we've all travelled, we all know that British TV is generally pretty good. And in a country like the States where people are used to paying for cable, then paying for this makes a lot of sense. But why would you bring this to the UK?
As has already been mentioned, it is to provide this kind of bulwark against Netflix. So they're hoping, according to the Drum article that we're taking this from, that other networks, other providers will be cajoled into taking part. Quote, providing a one-stop shop for British box sets, brand new commissions, and on-demand classics. So they do have this huge stock of content that isn't necessarily always available on iPlayer, on ITV Player, that they want to start monetizing. In the same way that, say, the BFI does with what it has. So from that point of view, I can absolutely see this making sense.
Yeah, maybe. maybe I'm just old-fashioned. So there's two sides of this, right? We bang on a regular basis about how lucky we are to have the BBC in this country because we don't have to deal with the bullshit of things like Fox News or whatever. Whatever's, you know, you can argue that the BBC is too pro-establishment, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, again, in the world decent news stakes, Britain does okay. So if we all go off and give our money to Netflix, that's not going to last. But also, isn't a license fee cheaper than having all these other networks? Like Netflix and Amazon and...
And also, even if you get Netflix and Amazon Prime, that only just tops how much you pay for a single license fee. It's about 12 quid a month. It's quite expensive.
Okay, so you're saying that this is explicit?
I don't think that's expensive for the BBC. I really don't. People need to get a freaking clue. You would spend that on three coffees, for Christ's sake.
If you have cancelled, if you are one of this growing trend of kind of cord cutters that you've cancelled your license fee, this is quite a good way of tempting you back, depending on their price point. But if you already have your license fee and the BBC are then asking you to pay extra to get access to sort of other stuff on top of it, at what point, I don't really know how the economics of that works out.
Yeah, see, maybe that's the bit I'm not getting. Maybe there's two different groups of people here. I'm thinking of the good, normal people with values who pay their license fee, and then all you other parasites.
Oh my God.
Just watching Netflix. And maybe that's right. So maybe in that sense, this is a good thing.
I've only been a parasite for 1 week.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? I've just figured this out. They're going to share their data. They're going to pull their data like Netflix does, and they're going to learn what people want to watch, and they're then going to commission stuff on with the same level of like data granularity that Netflix has. This isn't just a play for revenue. This is a play for user data.
Yeah, that makes sense. I can get that.
But Esther, you might have more objections to this next piece of news. Facebook is also not renewing funding for 2/3 of its existing news shows that it's commissioned for Facebook Watch.
There's a surprise. I've been waiting all week to say that.
Yeah, you all saw this coming.
We had hints of this already with Mike saying that they basically ended up collapsing because Facebook pulled about $5 million worth of funding. I think what actually tickled me most about this is that the spokesperson has said that they're not abandoning news, and it's not like the live deals. So they're kind of already acknowledging that they have screwed people over in the past. to be fair, the business decision is that, you know, rather than kind of, and this is from the Digiday article, rather than subsidising news publishers en masse, which they have no reason to do, they're functioning more as a TV network, and they're perfectly open to cancelling shows that aren't getting viewers. I don't think there's anything unreasonable about that from a business perspective. I have yet to see anybody in my friend's field or anybody really in this country that's really taken off with Watch.
Is it even in the UK?
Yeah, it launched in the UK last August.
Sorry, I mean, I've got to be honest, if I cared any less about a story, I'd be dead. But, sorry.
Okay, but
what
there
if is... Facebook did a license fee, would you care then? You know, Facebook has a scale to make it work, but my goodness me, they're making very slow progress.
Okay, so moving on then, talking about existing companies trying something new that we don't necessarily agree with. Facebook and Telegram are rolling out cryptocurrencies over the next year. So that's obviously going to be grist for Quartz's cryptocurrency newsletter. But in the meantime, what are our initial thoughts on this? Because it feels to me... Facecoins. It's going to be called Facecoins, and I hate that.
You're not joking.
It's not BookBits.
If it's called Facecoin, we riot.
My reaction to this is really f***ing hell. We really are in end times. And this just sounds nuts. Okay. I can barely talk about this because I just think it is really, really scary. Facebook, forget the other ones because I don't think they'll get anywhere because they haven't got the reach. What they're basically talking about, setting up part of the mechanism of a state. If they control the currency of used by 2 billion people, all they've got to do really is then set up the Facebook Defense Force and we're done.
You're talking about they're doing social sans frontier. They want to be their own nation state.
But that's their argument is that people in places that people in third world economies or whatever who don't have access to bank accounts can send money to their friends and family through WhatsApp cross border.
Which, to be fair, we've seen work for kind of Asia only social networks. So if you look at what, for instance, WeChat do, they have exactly that. It just seems like Facebook wants to take it more international.
What I really don't get about this is that Facebook, throughout the last 10, 11 years, how long they've been going, they have steered so clear of money. They won't touch financial stuff with the barge pole. You know, they've got an eBay style marketplace network that they've just been like, we're not even allowing payments. We're not touching it. We're not getting into that. And they never wanted to get to the stage where they were seen as a payment system, which just makes me think, why are they then leapfrogging like normal, everyday, what normal people use as money and going straight into cryptocurrencies?
It's not cryptocurrency like that. It's actually, this is where it's really actually quite scary. It's not like a speculative cryptocurrency. It's what they're calling a stable coin, which would be linked to value of real world currencies. So Facebook is talking about a basket. Facebook is talking about a basket of real world currencies and guaranteeing the value. So they would actually, like the Bank of England, they would say, oh, we've got a bunch of gold in Facebook towers that guarantees the value of this currency. They're becoming a bank.
That's just them. That's not a cryptocurrency. They've literally launched their own currency then.
Well, exactly. It's terrifying.
I wonder, imagine the days you can only buy food through Facecoin.
No, it's not going to be that. You know what? It is. It's going to be based on their, because they make the vast majority of their stuff through ad revenue. You're going to earn this currency through watching ads. in the same way that this is going to be the job. This is Brazil.
If you close your eyes, you starve to death.
Yeah, this is Terry Gilliam's Brazil. This is Robert Black Rankin's Apocalypse the Musical. This is Black Mirror. This is proper dystopian stuff. Does this have any bearing on publishers, or is this purely just kind of us going, well, we're very scared of Facebook
again? Well, it means that publishers, instead of not getting paid at all, can now not get paid in Facecoin.
All right. Okay. So moving on then. Medium is lowering its paywall for Twitter users. Peter, you have a theory about this. What would that be?
So there's a few things going on. Medium, I think, is struggling to find a sustainable business model. We know that. They've tried advertising.
I'm going to pull this out for a second time. There's a surprise.
They tried advertising. That didn't necessarily work. They tried allowing people
to put
their own paywalls up. They've now gone back to their Medium paywall. I think maybe what they're doing by dropping their paywall for Twitter users is trying to build loyalty. So last week they announced that they were going to build publishing brands on Medium. If they let people go straight to those brands from Twitter, they build up a loyal user base. If the content's good enough, they'll get people using it through Twitter. And then in the future, maybe then they can reintroduce the paywall once they've built that audience up. Or, and this is an interesting one, maybe there's a paid Twitter option.
Mm.
And we said it before, I personally love Medium. I love the content on Medium. There's so much diversity on there. There's such good writing. I wish they could find a solid, sustainable, ongoing business model.
I mean, there's a lot of garbage as well, but Twitter.
Is this not synergy between two cohabiting brands in the same way that Amazon and the Washington Post coexist? You have one person who has a lot of content and one person that is effectively a utility, and you're just trying to benefit both of them by doing it.
I don't think your average Twitter user cares about Medium in that way. Not yet. I think eventually they might, but
okay,
not
but
yet.
Surely that's about how they deploy it, about having Medium
absolutely.
Posts. So do you remember when people started talking about having lengthy posts within Twitter and everyone was up in arms and we ended up with a 280-character thing within Twitter? What if Medium, through integration with Twitter, was the way that you started having longer posts directly accessible through Twitter?
So Medium becomes the blogging arm of Twitter?
Yeah, so you have this news
that's
feed.
That's pretty cool.
Okay, so we've turned around on this.
Oh, like I said, I'm desperate for Medium to find a way forward because I think, there's a lot of shit on there, but there's a lot of shit everywhere. But
I think what is interesting as well this week is that Ev Williams, who he was one of the Twitter co-founders and he's the founder of Medium, he's actually stepped down from the Twitter board this week. And I wonder if that is to kind of preempt any antitrust accusations he's going to get. Because, what if
if Facebook is going on the way it's going and there's no antitrust people anywhere near it, Twitter and Medium have got nothing to worry about. Holy crap.
And then finally this week, one of the probably, disgustingly, considering what we've spoken about, one of the scariest pieces of news is a piece in The New Statesman by Helen Lewis, titled "Why Jeremy Corbyn's Media Bashing is Trumpian."
I mean, this was a great piece by Helen Lewis, and I think it says something that a lot of, sensible, normal, middle-of-the-road type people have been thinking, is that not just Jeremy Corbyn, he's in the firing line because apparently he's got a bit arsy in a Sky interview and said that the media is against him, and he regularly starts rallies by saying that the media is biased against him. And I guess that's the point. It's that idea that there's no effort going in to separate. God knows there's unfair, hostile headlines against Jeremy Corbyn in the British press, but there's no effort to separate that hostility from legitimate scrutiny. And that's what she's talking about. But it's the general scapegoating that seems to be prevalent in modern politics, whether it's Trump, whether it's Jeremy Corbyn, whether it's Theresa May. Do you remember that press conference when she was like, "Oh, it's just the press,
it's just defending the press.
Green, the orange man, baby.
He's rotting.
And that journalists are the enemies of the people thing, it's just really, it's a scary narrative.
You know what's particularly scary about this is the idea that at a time when the press is struggling to find its feet revenue-wise, we have the people who ostensibly should be supporting a free press who are then undermining it.
And I think the fact that with Corbyn, because he's left-leaning, more left-leaning maybe than you or I, but we're kind of willing to give him a pass.
No.
Oh, it's okay to have a go. No, we're not, obviously, because we wouldn't have brought it up. But Helen Lewis says, it's worrying that some people accept that the destruction of objective reality is a small price to pay for a Labour government.
And Owen Jones. Owen Jones.
Absolutely right. I don't know. The whole thing's just... This is a scary piece, and everyone should read it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in case you guys hadn't noticed, we do actually now offer transcripts of all our interviews. You can find the link either in our newsletter or if you go to the website, and there's a little transcripts link in the sidebar. And that's thanks to our partnership with Trint, who've got this kind of really cool automated AI transcription tool that does most of the work for you.
This week, we'll be hearing from Meg Kramer, senior producer of Trump Inc. and previous deputy director of BuzzFeed Audio. She took me through the mission of Trump Inc. and the difficulties of investigating a notoriously, let's say, private sitting president. For instance, she took me through how a tipster turned them onto a story about how one of Trump's golf courses was using the presidential seal as a distance marker, which it turns out is very illegal. We spoke about that, how the podcasting business might shake out, and how Trump Inc. finds its funding. But I began by asking her about Trump Inc. and its mission.
Trump Inc. started as an informal collaboration between ProPublica, this nonprofit investigative outlet, and WNYC, this nonprofit local public radio station in New York. And they collaborated around this story about the Trump Soho, which was a hotel condo development in Manhattan. And coming out of their reporting on this project, they sort of got together and said, what other stories might we want to do about Trump now that he's president? What other sort of business reporting can we do in this administration? And they, went into a room, got this whiteboard out, and wrote down everything they could think of. And what they had in the end was not so much a list of reporting ideas, but a very long list of unanswerable questions.
Amazed there was any space left on that whiteboard.
And they said, well, that's interesting. Maybe we should do something about those questions. And they sort of came up with a podcast as the way to approach all of these questions about Trump's business that can't be answered. Because in a podcast, you can sort of talk about uncertainty in a way that you can't really get into in a sort of big investigative piece. In an investigative piece, you have to draw conclusions. You have to say for sure. But in a podcast, you can lean more on this format of conversation to explore questions that you don't have answers to, or talk about, what's interesting about those questions. And, so we sort of came together. They brought me on to produce the show, and we came up with not so much a mission for the podcast, but sort of a driving question, which is, we have this unprecedented situation where we have a president with a sprawling business empire who, has not divested from it. It's in a trust, but not a blind trust. He can still draw income from it whenever he wants. And this really incredible lack of disclosure. And what we try to do is sort of solve that problem. And we've opened the project up to members of the public who want to contribute questions, story ideas, tips. We love getting tips. And we also work with other journalists, which is something that I have come to understand is a little unusual on this beat. It's a very competitive beat covering the president. We've created this space with this podcast where people can come and share the stories that we're working on. We hand off tips that aren't really going to be good for us. Maybe it's, the type of story that a journalist at the Washington Post might cover, but not something that we have the skills or the time to cover. And approach this project like a group project rather than something that we're sort of competing with each other on.
That is really, really interesting. And I suppose that's in part because of, who ProPublica are and what they do. It wouldn't necessarily be the case if it was, purely a for-profit organization.
I think that's true. And they have a very sort of open source ethos in their newsroom. They publish all the documents that they get. They really try to bring in other news organizations, local journalism organizations to collaborate. And I think that we have made a pretty strong case for this model, you know, and not just because we are uncovering stories and getting a better sense of how the Trump Organization works, but, you know, the journalists that we work with, I think, really enjoy working in this way. It's a very it's a very human way to do your work. And people just, I think, have a lot of fun when they work with us.
You mentioned right back at the start that the podcasting medium affords you the opportunity to do stuff that isn't necessarily as structured as, say, a long-form article would be, where you have to draw conclusions. Is that informality a strength when it comes to covering something as, you know, important as the Trump administration? Or is this, you know, or does that informality sometimes make your job harder, trying to marry that informality to the kind of importance of the mission that you do?
Well, it's a very studied informality. And we, you know, at some point in our production process, we have a script that has every word that's been said in the podcast written down. And we sit down and we go over that script and we fact check it very carefully. So, you know, it might sound informal, but we sort of put it through the same process that all other journalism has to go through. It's more the form that it takes that allows us to do that. I think the other thing is that when you work on these investigative stories, there's, I don't necessarily think they need to be so formal, but somehow a lot of investigative reporting does have a very sort of formal and stiff tone. We're interested in disrupting that model and making people care about the stories by, you know, entertaining them as they listen to them. And I think that ProPublica sees a lot of value in this podcast for that reason.
That is such a good testament to kind of the value of the podcasting, the podcast as a medium, I suppose. But Trump Inc. has this incredible team behind it. I was looking on the website. And is there anything that you find really surprises people about kind of the makeup of the team or even about the product that you put out? Is there anything that really takes people aback when you, you know, reveal a little bit of a little tidbit of information about it?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think that the thing that surprises people about all podcast production is that there is a producer who makes the podcast. It doesn't just sort of happen in this magical studio where people come together and everyone's brilliant and everything that they say is amazing.
Oh, I can guarantee you that that's not the case. The amount of editing we have to do every week on our news roundup.
So, yeah, I think, you know, and you know, when you're at a party and you say that you work in podcasting, people are often like, oh, I love podcasts. You know, my favorite shows are Radiolab and Invisibilia and This American Life. And, you know, what do you do?
Yeah.
Like, well, I don't make a show like that. But, you know, and you sort of have to educate people about what your work is if you want them to understand how difficult your job is. But I think that the people who work on this show, I mean, I have really come to love them. They are so brilliant. They are amazing reporters, and they get together every week and just work on this project together. And it's so fun to be a part of a team like that.
Well, you got your start personally in journalism at Michigan Radio. So what was your position there? And what does producer entail then for those people who don't necessarily know exactly what you do? This would be a good opportunity for you to always point people towards this.
So I started at Michigan Radio as a production intern working on All Things Considered, which is this afternoon news show distributed by NPR. And what the local stations do is they, you know, build some news programming around this national show when they distribute it. And then I worked on a project called Changing Gears, which was a local journalism collaboration between a handful of Midwestern local public radio newsrooms that were focused on this bigger story of the changing Midwest economy. And my role on that project was a mix of reporting and audience engagement. And so after doing that, I went back to being a producer. The sort of role of a producer is really different depending on what show you work on and what shop you work in. On Trump Inc., it's a mix of project management, so how the whole team comes together every week to make the show, and also doing the work of storytelling and having a really clear vision for what the big story is. So, you know, stepping in and writing or reporting or editing. On Trump Inc., we're a very collaborative team, so sometimes we take turns being the producer. nobody has offered to sort of take on the production schedule for me yet, but other parts of production, we can pass it around to give, you know, different people on the team a chance to do the work in a different way.
That, again, is something I'm very jealous of, that kind of the very fluid nature of the work. Sounds like something that, you know, more people should be doing, particularly around projects like this.
Well, it's something that I learned. I mean, I don't know if I brought that to the team or if it was sort of part of the team already, but it's something that I learned working at BuzzFeed, where I was part of the audio team there. And we had a group of producers. We called ourselves the Pod Squad. It was an all women production team. And it's the most collaborative environment that I've ever worked in. Everybody worked on each other's projects. We really saw ourselves as a small studio where everyone was working together to get things done. And I mean, it's a model that I want to look for in, you know, all of the work that I do going forward.
So in the UK, at least, there are some indications that podcasting might be about to disrupt traditional talk radio in the same way that Spotify and other streaming services have done to music-based radio in the UK. So what is it then about podcasting as a medium that is so appealing and that's kind of so that's led it to grow to the point where now some talk radio is looking at it a little bit of askance?
Yeah, I think that relationship with the host is something that you have to have in podcasting that you don't necessarily have to have in terrestrial radio, because there's a more limited offering. Mm. This sort of model incentivizes that kind of personality driven content. And I mean, I also think it's because, you know, it's on demand. You can listen to it whenever you want, wherever you are. It's for the most part completely free. Mm. It is pretty high quality for completely free programming. You can get a lot of the things that you can get on the radio on podcasts, and there's a seemingly endless amount of it. You know, I think it would be really hard to run out of good podcasts to listen to.
Yeah, certainly.
It's very captivating in that way.
It's interesting as well that a lot of the strengths that you mentioned there, the idea that you do have this one-to-one relationship with host, was necessarily born out of the fact that, for the most part, podcasting was done on a very cheap and cheerful way, you know, where all you had was a microphone, the host, and, you know, the research that they'd done. So it's kind of the limitations of the medium have really enabled it to grow and almost surpass its, you know, more traditional counterpart.
Yeah, and I think that the same, you know, those same factors are also limiting for podcasting, right? Mm-hmm. Because it still is very expensive to make, you know, quality in-depth news programming, for example. And I think in the US, we have seen that there are a couple of podcasts that offer, you know, some kind of news programming that may be drawing people away from, you know, public radio stations like NPR, mm-hmm. but that it's really difficult to have a robust newsroom behind an independent podcast that can give you the same thing that a radio newsroom can. And the shows that are, you know, successful news podcasts like The Daily or Post Reports have these giant newsrooms behind them, and they're taking that journalism and putting it on a new platform.
And so how do you foresee the podcast industry changing over the next few years? We've seen Spotify making some big acquisitions this week, both on the kind of content creation side and on the monetization side. As the medium becomes slightly more mature, how do you sort of see it all shaking out? Will professionalism become more to the fore, or will it still maintain its, you know, informal nature?
I wish I knew. I mean, when I get together with friends and we talk about this, you know, people have theories, but I don't think anybody has a really strong evidence-backed understanding of what's going to happen to podcasting beyond sort of the broadest trends that lead to things like Spotify buying Gimlet.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what I'm seeing now, and it's sort of the shorter term, is that a lot of organizations really want to try podcasting, that they're really excited about it as a way to grow their digital news. Well, you know, we had been talking about this new program that Slate launched this week, Supporting Cast, which is this layer that allows podcasters to create a membership model with their listeners and provide higher value content that they charge for, basically. And because podcasting is RSS based, I think, and you know, podcasters are dependent on these platforms like, you know, Apple Apple and Spotify to release their content, it's really hard for the creator to get in there and say, why don't you pay me a little bit of money for this? Mm. You know, I don't know if you do you have Patreon in the UK?
We do. There's a few very high profile successes, but for the most part, it seems to be, you know, the ones that really work are the ones that are US based.
So I give $1 a month to one of my favorite podcasts, Who Weekly, which is a podcast about celebrities that you've never heard of. And they, you know, because I am a contributing member of their Patreon, I get a special RSS feed, sort of a secret RSS feed with bonus content that I can listen to whenever I want. Hmm. Even though I make podcasts, I still have not figured out how to actually access that RSS feed. I'm sure I could do a little bit more research to figure it out, but it's pretty challenging, you know, for someone who publishes RSS feeds to not be able to know how to do it. So I'm excited to see Slate offer this. I also am excited about it because I think right now the podcast revenue model encourages all kinds of things that are not the kinds of shows that I want to work on. Mm. You know, the ad revenue model for podcasts encourages you to make the cheapest podcast you can because you want to make those ad dollars pay for the production that you're doing. And it sort of pushes you into this personality-driven programming where you want to build a relationship with your audience, build loyalty with your audience in the cheapest way possible, which is sort of two people sitting around a microphone format. Mm-hmm. And then you can make the sort of small ad dollars that you could get out of podcasting cover your production costs and then maybe make a little money on top of that. This sort of membership model or this model where people pay for the content, I think incentivizes creators to make a product that has a lot of value rather than something that is lean enough to be profitable. You know, and I think that this model, which is in many ways the public radio model, the ProPublica model, really prioritizes the work rather than the business of making the work.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if it's going to work. I don't know if this is going to like help people make money off of making their podcasts, but I think it sets up a structure that I think is very encouraging and I think is really good for podcast creators.
So there's a bit of a segue there into how you actually manage the relationship with your own audience. You know, so to what extent are you going back and forth with your audience to get feedback and sort of maybe even develop new ideas for the show?
We have a tips line, and we have a researcher who manages the tips line and reads every email that we get, responds to many of them. Sometimes we just get kind of basic research questions. People are curious about something and we'll answer that question. And sometimes we get real tips that turn into stories that nobody else has had. So we had a tipster email us to say that there was to tip us off to a story about a Trump golf course that had ordered this sort of replica of the presidential seal to use as a yard marker for like the 44th yard they were putting down these presidential seals where they were going to. That's actually illegal. You can't use the presidential seal for anything other than the president. And it was this kind of bizarre overlap between Trump's business and his presidency. And we were able to get that story because somebody told us about it and because we opened our tip line to people who wanted to contribute.
And then just as a final question, what would be the last piece of media you consumed in any medium that you'd wholeheartedly recommend to our audience?
Oh, I love this question.
That's so strange. Normally it's the hardest one. People deliberate for about half an hour before they answer.
Well, I have a goal this year to spend less time on my phone. Mm-hmm. And so I've tried to articulate something positive instead of like, don't spend time on your phone. It's spend more time reading. So I'm trying to read a book every week. And I recently read this memoir called Old in Art School, which is written by the historian Nell Painter, whose most well-known work is another book called The History of White People, which is also fantastic. And this memoir, Old in Art School, is about quitting her job as a professor at Princeton and going back to school to get an MFA in painting in her 60s.
Wow.
And it's it's just such a delightful, funny book about, you know, really what it is like to be old in art school surrounded by young, cool people. But what I found most meaningful about it was her art education at the end of her program sort of turns around and influences how she thinks as a historian. It pushes her to think about her discipline in very creative and interesting ways. And she's so brilliant. So it's very exciting to read about how her mind works. And I would strongly recommend this book to anyone. You don't have to be a historian or an artist to enjoy it.
For those of you who don't regularly visit it, we do have a website. You can go to voices.media and find our back catalogue of newsletters and our back catalogue of transcriptions of all the interviews that we've done. We don't mention it enough. I think it's an absolutely fantastic resource for everybody, so I would really encourage everybody to go and check it out. That is voices.media.
So if you're a really social kind of person, get on Twitter, have a look for us at Media Voices Pod. We're always there. We're always very social.
And just to give you an idea of some of the guests we've got coming up, next week we've got Nikki Simpson, who is going to talk to us about the Magazine Centre. We've also got Chadden Hunter, who is a producer at BBC Planet Earth. We've got Marco Bertozzi, who is the VP EMEA of Spotify, and that's all coming up in March.
I'm speechless. That's some guest list. Oh my God.
Until next week, when we're going to be back with one of those fantastic guests that Esther mentioned, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.